Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today, I'm really pleased to invite Jim Krantz as our special guest, and we're going to be thinking about the century of systems. Jim Krantz is an organizational consultant and a researcher from New York City. He's the principal of Work Lab Consulting. Jim has written extensively about the unconscious in organizations, the dilemmas of leadership, and how authority plays out in new forms of organizations. His PhD is in system sciences from the Wharton School. In addition to consulting, Jim's been on several faculties, including Yale and Wharton. He's also been past president of the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations. He's a fellow of the A.K. Rice Institute, member of Opus, and chair of the Management Committee of Organizational and Social Dynamics Journal. Jim, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing great, and it's a pleasure to be here, Simon. I want to thank you for inviting me to join in on these podcasts.
And where are you talking from today, Jim? Let's hear where you are.
I am sitting in a beach house that we have on a small island, which is a 30-minute ferry ride south of Long Island, if that means anything to you, in the Atlantic Ocean. It's where we've been coming in the summertime for many years, and it's the perfect place to hide out from COVID-19. So,
well, that sounds good, and we have a connection because I'm 5 minutes from the Atlantic Ocean on the other side of the pond, so the water connects us. Let's talk about systems. You've had a long path in systems. You studied at a PhD level. Where did systems begin to interest you? Where did it start for you?
You know, Simon, I'm not exactly sure, but it goes way back before that. I mean, I've wondered about that myself. I left undergraduate college for a year in 73 to join, was at the time, the Serpico investigations, which was a big corruption investigation in the New York Police Department. And what drew me to it was the police commissioner was trying to use systems theory to address police corruption rather than to try to address it as a rotten apple in the barrel model, to try to look at how the system incentivizes or discourages itself corrupt behavior. So there was something going back then that really interested me about it. And when I think about it, I actually trace it back to my own upbringing because I was a Jewish kid in Lincoln, Nebraska in the 50s. And I don't know if you appreciate that, but to be a Jewish kid in Lincoln, Nebraska in the 50s meant you experienced marginality and you were in a place where you observed things and were often at arm's length and you were often kept at arm's length. And I was also marginal in my own family of origin for reasons that aren't important for this podcast. But what it did is it enabled me to be comfortable on the margins. Mm-hmm. I know how to breathe on the margins. I know how to think on the margins. A lot of people get anxious if they're not in the center. Yeah. I get anxious if I am in the center because the margins is, and I think margins give you a perspective, an ability to think systemically and look holistically that I found extremely valuable. So I think it goes way back then, my interest, but it's been a through line for my whole life is this interested in how wholes operate and how things are connected to one another and the systemic properties. So it goes way back for me.
I think it's interesting that you say, you tell your story because many people, when they think about systems, they think about kind of complexity theory and they think about feedback loops and that they go to a sort of scientific-y place. And you bring it right back to kind of the human level about kind of a human systems and what it does to people, marginalized people, thinking from the edges. I think that's very helpful.
Yeah, there's a whole, I guess we could call it technocratic dimension to systems theory and system thinking, which is useful.
Sure.
But it's only useful if you can keep it in perspective. But yes, at that big turn of events in the middle of the 20th century that the Tavistock founders were involved with Eric Trist and Fred Emery, and being able to use systems thinking, which had been around for a couple thousand years, to be able to use it to understand human systems and has been an extraordinary development, extraordinarily important development. And it really, I think, prepared us for what I'm calling the century of the system. But what I mean by that is that we're at a place in history where systems thinking is becoming more and more necessary for survival and ongoing development. I think to understand that, it's useful to have sort of a large sweep of history that I learned when I was in my graduate studies from Eric Trist and Russ Acuff. And I was very much sort of inculcated in this way of thinking. But it really goes back to the emergence out of the medieval times. I mean, in the medieval world was a very harsh place to be. I mean, 95% of the people never went more than 5 miles from their homes. And the age expectancy was something like 28 or 32 or something. And life was tough and poverty was abject. And there was only one goal back then, which was to get to heaven. And all the art and all the literature was organized around that. But then when we had the emergence of the Renaissance and humanism and the Enlightenment, people started to think differently about the world and developed an image of the world, which really has held sway for the last 400 years. And that was the image of the world as a machine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sort of the iconic moment for that was, of course, the laws of thermodynamics, Isaac Newton, which has been the most highly corroborated scientific theory in history, although now we know it's been disconfirmed. That governed the mental model that people had all the way up through the industrial era and where we are today. And it was a model of the world which was based on the idea that if you want to understand things, you take them apart and you look at different parts and you see how those parts are connected with one another and you see what causes what and what's the cause and effect. And it's been extraordinarily rich and important for our civilization, and it's brought about untold progress and advances. It also depends upon the idea that you can only understand how pieces are related to one another if you keep the environment out of the picture.
Yeah.
And I wish we had more time to go into what that way, that model of the world was all about. Oh, incidentally, Isaac Newton developed these laws during a pandemic when he had left the university and he himself was hiding out on his island to try to avoid the pandemic. And this is what he came up with. So who knows what's being cooked up now?
Sure.
But in any case, that was a model of the world that was so important. And it's a way of understanding the world, which is people call analysis. And it becomes such a predominant way of seeing the world that analysis became equated to thought itself. But really, analysis is a special case. Mm-hmm. And we're learning more and more about that special case as we are learning more and more about the world that has emerged now cannot be comprehended or addressed with the machine model. And there's a connection to it because the industrial world created all kinds of complexities and interdependencies through the genius of the scientific revolution that can no longer be addressed by the same ways of thinking. And that's where systems thinking comes in, because systems is a model of the world which is able to take account of complexity and interdependence and the dynamics which have been created, which we can no longer address through the mechanistic thinking. And systems model offers an alternative to analysis, is what we call synthesis, which is a way of thinking which, instead of taking things apart, understands them by putting them together. And you know, the common way of thinking, of course, is the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. But that's very much a part of common sense today. But if you really stop to think about it, it's asking us to think about what is that whole that is more than the sum of the parts? What is that? What are those properties?
Yeah.
And that's what systems theory is interested in, is the properties that are created from the interactions of the parts but are not in the parts themselves. They only arise from the interactions, from the interdependence, from the complexity. What are these properties? And that's what systems theory is trying to help us understand.
That's a really helpful explanation. And I mean, what I find in my work around eco-leadership and working with ecosystems and organizational ecologies is that people kind of get this at a conceptual level, but they slip very quickly back into that mechanistic way of thinking where we're so hardwired and conditioned by the last century's thinking. I think that people still, that they, you know, you go to an OD, an organizational development kind of a conference, or you try and develop some work, and people get the idea of systems thinking, and then they go and plan something which is about the parts, that they do something functional and reductionist because that's so kind of hardwired in the system. So I think working towards that change is the work we're trying to do. And you did some of that work with the social technical work in the Tavistock, didn't you? That's kind of where that it really opened up into the workplace. Do you want to share some of that thinking?
Yeah, so let me get there in a little bit roundabout way, because what you said, I think, is something I really want to respond to, which is this tendency to revert to mechanistic thinking. And if I understand your thinking, you are getting to the idea that this is a deeply held mental model. And of course, these are, you know, these exist at the level of our worldviews and our paradigms. So, you know, like the fish in the water, the fish don't notice the water in the same way, and we don't notice our own. But there's something else I want to say about it that ties us into psychodynamics and brings us to the socio-technical, which is that systems thinking is very depriving. It's very depriving because it takes away from us the capacity to blame or to attribute to others explanations for things. And of course, blame and attribution is one of the great salves we have in our, it's a great salve for hurt feelings and for distress and for uncertainty and so forth. But if you think systemically, you're no longer able, you cannot locate responsibility in system. It's the outcome of a system as a result of the interactions. It's not the result of any location in the system. Mm-hmm. And in fact, objectivity, you know, every way of thinking has its own God terms. You know, psychoanalysis, we have the unconscious. In systems thinking, we have the system, which is unknowable because we're all located in the system and our location shapes our experience and our perception. And so we have to be in a systems frame of mind. You have to accept the limitations of your understanding, and you have to accept that we can't use the gratification of blame or attribution of explanation of others. And maybe most importantly, we have to recognize that we absolutely need the other. You know, in the more mechanistic model, the other tends to be a source of, it's easy to hate the other because the other reminds us of what we don't know. The other reminds us of what's beyond our comprehension, beyond our control. And as a result, it's very easy to hate the other, and it's very easy to create a kind of toxic communication between the inner other and the outer other that leads to all sorts of cruel social policies and the certainty that fuels authoritarianism comes from denying the reality of the other and the uncertainty. So I think that systems thinking really challenges us not only on the intellectual and conceptual level, but on the emotional level as well in these ways. And we have to come to recognize that the other is essential to us, which is why I see psychoanalysis as a moral proposition, because the psychoanalysis is a way of thinking which puts us into empathic connection with the other within as well as the other without. And so for me, psychodynamic thinking is an essential part of being able to think systemically. And that's where the socio-technical comes in. It was a way to bring that appreciation in to understanding the technical systems and the formal organization and recognizing that in order to organize, we have to take into account these other factors.
That's very, very helpful. Your clarity is wonderful, Jim. I mean,
well, when you get to be 70, everything reminds you of something else.
I'm quite struck by, you know, that a lot of the work I've been reading around the complex adaptive systems, Senge's work, and a lot of people said that it didn't actually impact that much on organizations. And I think the reason is because of those disconnections you're making, because that kind of social technical piece wasn't done, the kind of psychological work, the understanding of our attachments to ways of being, to blaming the other, all the things you've shared, I think is absolutely vital. And yeah, I totally agree that psychoanalysis really is a vital part of that kind of systems journey if we're going to move forward, because otherwise we just keep on hitting the same resistance.
Absolutely. Psychoanalysis is what enables us to embrace the other and to recognize that our interdependency is not a constraint, but it frees us to be able to understand and do things. I mean, I think that, you know, you mentioned the Senge, and I mean, something that for me is sad, and I think one of the challenges we all have is that there tends to be a splitting of the technical and the social, the psychodynamic and the formal organization. And I think that splitting, we can understand it in psychodynamic terms, because to integrate them creates anxiety. And so when the Tavistock tradition came over to the States, it tended to be split apart, and the psychodynamic part went to A.K. Rice, and then the formalistic technical part went to U.S. University of Southern California and other places. Mm-hmm. And both were depleted as a result of the splitting. And I think to reclaim it, I think we have to recognize the essential interdependence of these two ways of thinking. And there's a lot of, you know, I mentioned the art in the Middle Ages. And then, of course, the art in the Renaissance, Enlightenment, Industrial Era was much more focused on reality and an actual picture reality. Well, now, as we're going into what I call the century of the system, we're seeing the art also now recognize that there's something behind the representation, and that the reality is not a stable, fixed feature. And sort of the early science of the 20th century helped open us to recognizing uncertainty as a necessary element of understanding physical reality. And the art also has taken a turn towards recognizing the emotional truths behind the surface. And of course, art and science are usually ahead of the rest of us. And I think now we're social science, we're beginning to catch up and recognize that to address the problems we have today, these are problems that don't have solutions. We're not going to solve these complex issues. We can address them, we can work with them, we can manage them, but only if we understand them systemically and recognize our interdependence. I mean, it used to be that we thought nation states could solve problems or corporations could solve problems, but nobody can solve climate. Nobody can solve income inequality. Nobody can solve many of these things through isolated entities competing with one another. But I think we're kind of stuck with coming to terms with the fact that to move to a systems approach to addressing problems, we also have to have a new way of thinking about authority, a way of thinking about authority that's not as infantilizing, and a way of thinking about authority which is much more what Eric Trist called in the Greek model of shared authority moving around, rather than the Roman model, which is the model of a sort of the authority coming from a certain point. And this is where I think we need to do a whole lot of work, how to create authority, that kind of authority, which can allow us to address things systemically.
Yeah. And again, I totally agree with you. And I think the psychoanalysis really helps again, because we read a lot about distributed leadership and how important it is. And yet, unless you distribute containment, find a way of distributing containment and find a way of doing it differently from the last century, then you're not going to distribute leadership. You're not going to distribute authority. We have to find new ways of doing this.
It's so true. I mean, it's such an important point that you're making. I mean, to me, it's so profound. I mean, we used to, you know, we learned so much from Bion and Mengus and these fantastic, amazingly brilliant founders of this tradition about issues of containment, but it was all based on that model, the later 20th century model of containment arising from stable small group boundaries. And now we don't have that kind of containment, and we need to do the work. The next chapter of Bion, for example, I think, is to understand the movement of emotion in unbounded groups.
Yeah.
And how that happens. I mean, I live very near where the trade towers were. Mm-hmm. And 9/11, of course, it's an important moment 20 years on now for 9/11, but it was a very traumatic event for many of us and a very personal event for those of us who were living in the shadow of the World Trade Centers and were having to cope with the dust of, and the fear of it. But one of the things I noticed was that the way some of the emotions were contained was by stories that were told from person to person. And it was very much a kind of a way of seeing networks in action, containing emotion through the transmission of stories. And I thought so much about that. I hope we can do some more thinking about how emotions are contained in unbounded groups and in networks and in these new forms of organizations, because that's the next step of our work, I believe.
Yeah, I think it is. And, you talk 9/11. I was there just before, and I came back out 2 weeks later, and I'm just as you talk about it, I just remember the burning smell in the air was just striking, really. But yeah, the link to stores as containment. I mean, I'm really trying to work to understand new ways to distribute containment, because it is very different from the way we were trained to do it. And I study social movements as well. The other thing, you know, in New York, the Occupy movement, I studied them in London and New York and spent time. And it's quite interesting to see how they kind of struggle with these same issues. You know, they don't have the answers, but they're edge leaders. They do some things which are interesting. And you can see that, you know, they try and work without hierarchy, without the same stable forms of leadership and authority. And sometimes they have great innovations, and sometimes they fall back on old failures where they get into splitting, and they do the same things, but they're very interesting to study, I think.
Yeah, Occupy was very interesting, both in its aspiration, but it's also, like you're saying, in its brittleness and its frailty, because really they weren't really able to recreate an emotional reality beyond it. I one of the interesting things, very interesting bit of research I followed in network analysis is about, you know, where good ideas come from. And there's a lot of research now to show that where good ideas come from is people who are standing on the edges of clusters and networks.
Yeah.
And that's where good ideas come from. And I think the same is true of innovation and creativity and the kind of development that we're interested in, which is it's going to come from people who are what Eric Trist used to call the reticulists, the people who span the boundaries.
Yeah.
And that's where what he called the new directions of hope. And for him, the new directions of hope were for these reticulists and for ways in which people in communities could become agents of each other's success rather than in competition with each other, and become agents of each other's success by creating domain-based organizations, which again take a different kind of authority.
So I
think that's, in my mind, sort of where this conversation goes, to that kind of thinking, and how do we create entities and organizations that go beyond the individual corporation or the individual nation state.
Yeah, my work has led me to kind of talk about technological, social, and environmental ecosystems and making these connections all the time, because I find that even with system thinkers, quite often that these things get divided. So they go and do the technical piece of it, or they go and do the human resources bit of it in an organization, and then they try and put these two different pieces together. Very rarely do they go out into the environmental piece to think about the kind of the wider environmental issues, the lived-in environments, the built environments they live in, and start making sense of themselves in the world in a different way. And making those connections, I think, is some of the work and actually doing that work.
Oh, Simon, I just couldn't agree more. It's actually exciting in a way to hear you say these things to me. But I think, in the group relations tradition, the Tavistock tradition, systems thinking is kind of stunted. I mean, nobody's surprised anymore to know that the staffs of Michelle and Barack Obama could tell when the two of them were getting along, because that's when the staffs were getting along. Yeah. And, you know, we know that there's parallel processes and that they're powerful. Understanding that is a powerful source of helping our clients and so forth. And I've done a lot of work on the way in which we as consulting teams can use the way in which parallel processes are invoked in us to understand unspoken parts of our client systems and so forth. So, I think that's important. But what you're saying is much more important, which is in systems thinking, the unit of analysis is not the person, is not the group, is not the organization. It's the person and the environment.
Yeah.
In mechanistic thinking, the environment was eliminated so that we could understand the linear connection of cause and effect. But in systems thinking, we have to reintroduce the environment. In fact, the environment is the only thing which makes the system comprehensible.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the source code error of capitalism, in my opinion, was the idea of the primacy of the shareholder. And in my view, we could move to a moral capitalism if we recognize the unit of analysis was the corporation and its environment.
Yeah.
And the nation and its environment and the person. And so to bring the environment back into the explanatory, at the center of the explanatory form, to me, that's where we can move capitalism to be more moral. And that kind of systems thinking that just focuses more on parallel processes is important, but it's very limited and it loses the greatest power of systems thinking, which is to recognize that the unit of analysis is no longer the individual, but the individual in its environment.
And are you seeing movement in the corporate sector, the financial sector, towards that? There is a recognition I'm seeing in the finance sector about thinking beyond just shareholder value. There is this language now, which was not there a decade ago, was it?
Yeah, I absolutely think it's true. And I think that it's has to do with generational change. But the nature of leadership is evolving away from the sort of heroic command model to recognizing that corporations are really idea chambers, and that yes, all of these directions of recognizing other stakeholders, not just shareholders, and realizing that the environment is a crucial aspect. I think there is development in that front, and I think it will continue as we die off, and as the generation that has grown up with systems thinking much more integrated into them, and that's been partly the result of the information revolution. I mean, one of the challenges to the mechanistic model that really helped undermine it was when information started to become a focus of science and understanding, not only information theory, but also the computerization and all that, because you can't understand information the same way that you can understand machines. And you can only understand information in a holistic way. And I think people who've come up in the information world and are going to do a lot to help move this forward into a systems framework.
Yeah, and I think our role with bringing in psychoanalysis and into this picture is to try and keep up with that move and not just hold on to our kind of elite forms of knowledge and stay in our own clubs and actually really join with the network society as I talk about and trying to make those connections and offer our understanding. That really excites me. That work really excites me.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I think there's also in that connection, you know, there's so much distress today around white supremacy and about the impact of white European culture. And I think we offer a very useful critique of that, although it's not often recognized because it's for a variety of reasons, but this psychodynamic approach to systems thinking offers a critique to the white supremacist European model, and the critique on two dimensions. One is it brings emotion up alongside reason as an important source of understanding, and B, it is a critique of individualism because it recognizes that we are not, quote unquote, the captains of our own ship. But there's an underlying connectedness to us that is beyond our control, but has a profound shaping effect on how we see ourselves and how we conduct ourselves. I think we have also a lot to offer to this particular historical moment, which is around these kind of issues. I mean, we're all obviously implicated in structures of privilege. I think we can bring something to that conversation through psychodynamics and systems thinking.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, when we hear about institutionalized racism or something, it's not a shock to us. It's kind of we know that these systems exist, and it doesn't just belong to the three bad guys who made the errors or did the bad things. It's kind of it's much more systemic than that, and that's been part of our understanding. And I think you're right that we can really work. Not just in organizations, but actually in society. I mean, this is the other bridge I'm working on all the time. Is you can't separate nature from humans. We are nature, and you can't separate kind of society from organizations. They're not closed systems. It's always kind of making that connection, isn't it? Always kind of seeing how society infiltrates me, you, the teams you're working in, the organizations we're working in, and vice versa.
Yes. You know, people use the word systemic racism, and they use that word systemic. And this comes back to the point you were making about, you know, the defenses actually against thinking systemically. Mm-hmm. And one of the great defenses against thinking systemically is by turning it into something much thinner and much more mechanistic and much more concrete than it really is. And oftentimes I hear people talking about systemic racism, and I have asked them, well, what do you mean by systemic? And I just think there's so much more when coming to terms with systemic racism to think about the systemic part of it, not only about the racism part of it.
Yeah.
And that the usually in my experience today, when people use the word systemic racism, they're talking about racism and have no appreciation of the complexity and the meaning of the word systemic in that connection. So that's something else I think we can bring into that conversation.
Absolutely. We're coming towards an end, Jim. This has been really fascinating. I'm sure the audience is going to be very interested in what you shared. I'd like to ask guests a question at the end of the podcast around if they have any thoughts around what it means to live a good life and create the good society. From your experience?
I have a lot of thoughts about that, and I guess I'm a little reluctant to say them in a way, because I think sometimes things that are very personal people come across as cliches.
Yeah.
But I would say this, which is something I've been writing about lately, which is I think it has to do with two things, curiosity and humility. curiosity is the best antidote for projection I've ever seen. Because projection is all about the creation of knowledge that where it doesn't exist. And curiosity is about asking about, you know, it's about calling that into question. And I think, to me, curiosity, the more I do my consulting work and so forth, I think with my clients and so forth, I think curiosity is such an essential part of humanity and living a good life and being open. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, that I really do believe that humility is the face of the other. Mm-hmm. That humility is all about recognizing the otherness, what we can't understand, what we can't control, what we need, but throws us off our sense of certainty and knowing. And I think that is a very important aspect of living what I think is a good life, is recognizing that the role of the other, and doing so, having the humility of recognizing that we don't come from a preferred perspective, that, and we're not in control, and that we really need the others. And again, that comes back to systems, which is all about interdependence and recognizing that, that, you know, the how much truth resides in the interdependence.
That's lovely sharing, Jim. Thank you very, very much. And I mean, I'd like to personally thank you for your work over the years. You've inspired me. You've been a mentor. And thank you for sharing your generously with the audience. It's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon. I feel exactly the same about you. And thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training, and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.